From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, in an era in which there's more data than ever, how do you create a weather forecast that's relevant to everyone?
Later, why the Jazz Estate on Milwaukee's east side is a great place to watch and listen to music.
Every seat, you're right by the stage. So sometimes when you're watching a performance, you're really right in the performance with the artist, which is really neat. And I think that's been one of the successes of the estate over the years.
And from jazz to surf rock, why Milwaukee's Rev-O-Matics evolved for their second album.
Yeah, there's a lot more character on this. And we played so much between the last album and when we decided to record. And a lot happened in my life personally. Like, I had more kids. You know, I was just juggling all sorts of old guy responsibilities.
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. There was a time when most of us got our weather news in one of two ways, either from a broadcast meteorologist on TV or radio, or from the weather page in the print edition of the daily newspaper.
Of course, those sources still exist today. You may well have heard our forecast from UWM's Innovative Weather during Morning Edition earlier.
But they exist alongside a myriad of other sources, from 24/7 TV weather reports to apps on your smartphone to an icon in the lower corner of your computer monitor to the dashboard of your car. And for people who are especially motivated, there are countless websites that promise levels of weather sophistication that weather geeks could only have dreamed of 20 years ago.
And that makes the business of delivering weather information complicated. Mike Westendorf is operations manager for the aforementioned Innovative Weather and a regular Lake Effect guest. Good morning, Mike. Welcome back to the show.
It is great to be back.
So in a complex environment for weather information, how do you find your niche?
That's a great question, and I'll say that it's even more complicated than that because everybody who is an individual user has a different set of expectations. You know, that I think becomes one of the biggest challenges, you know, for just our listening audience. We have people who are going to be out on Lake Michigan, and we have people who are going to be playing softball or volleyball, and we have people who are going to be inside all day. And all of them, when they say, "What's the weather like for me?" it all has different connotations. So I think that becomes, quite frankly, one of the largest challenges that we face, is that it is such a differing audience, and we can't make assumptions that they're all looking for the same thing, because we certainly hear about it if we do.
Well, and much like, you know, doctors must have this issue where, you know, people come in for a doctor's appointment and they've scarfed down any number of different medical information websites. You probably have to deal with people who have far different understandings of what the weather is and what it means.
Very much so. And, you know, there's another interesting thing about this. And I'll answer that question with this idea that we're in the data age. There is so much data out there. And like you said, you can call up a website and it will give you a forecast data. And I think that that's one of the things that we don't really think about. Who made the forecast? Where did it come from? Was it looked at by a human being? Is it just model data? Is it, what does it mean for me? I think that that's another piece of it, is if you have that, just that information, a number, a temperature, a percent possibility of precipitation, all it is a number. Who translates that for you? Who, you know, how do you make sense of what that number actually means for you? Was the forecast for your neighborhood, for your city, for a great big area of southeastern Wisconsin? This becomes, I think, one of the challenges that all of us who like, and I love the doctor analogy. My in-laws are doctors, and they would talk about it all the time. You go and you Google it, and sometimes that just causes way more stress, you know, than you ever need. And people do the same thing with forecasting. And then, of course, when they hear a forecaster, they got this data someplace online, and they say, "Oh, you guys are all wrong," or that story didn't make any sense. And so it's very much, very similar. And I think that the important thing for us as a public to remember is there's a difference between data and somebody who walks with you to interpret that data.
Right. So this is when you're choosing a doctor. You know, anybody can take your blood pressure or your temperature or, you know, look at test results. But the where the rubber hits the road is how much you trust the person that's interpreting that.
Yeah. And what kind of relationship do you have with them? Do they understand your history? Do they understand your unique needs? Things of that nature. And we talk about it all the time at Innovative Weather, that there's a difference between making a forecast and assessing risk. And I like to call it relational information. That's what we provide when we talk, you know, where we're working with one of our partners directly. If it's a general forecast, we try to put some discussion around it, like you'll see on the WWM webpage. We'll have a little bit of a discussion and some narrative about it. But I don't know your story. I don't know what it is. So I'm really giving you a forecast that has some data that I hope will be useful. When you have a partnership with somebody, that's a different deal. I understand what makes you nervous. I understand why it makes you nervous. And now when I give you a number, there's a lot of weight behind that number because I understand more and you understand more because of that relationship.
Well, let me ask you something. You can speak from the Innovative Weather standpoint in this question, but there are a lot of other organizations and companies out there that produce weather forecasts and weather products out there. How much, when we hear a weather forecast from you or whomever, how much of the information that you're using is proprietary information and how much is, you know, data collection from, you know, sort of generally accessible sources? Like, you know, how much are you using information that comes from the National Weather Service and how much are you generating on your own?
Right. That's a great question. And the reality of it is that all of us, we're very fortunate in the world when it comes to this country, the investment that has been made in the weather infrastructure. The National Weather Service likes to call it the weather enterprise, and they really view it from data to what they do to how they help other people like us do what we do. It's all interconnected. So the fact of the matter is that whether it's us or whether it's the local TV folks or it's the National Weather Service, we have access to all of the same data. Now, there are some things that we do. We take some of that data. We may run a model, like we have a high resolution model that we use. That's a little bit proprietary, but a lot of companies are doing that many times over. But we're all kind of taking the same source data to be able to get some additional tools. Here's where the rubber meets the road. Again, it comes back to my relationship with our listeners or our partners, and then the story that we tell. And I think that this is really what separates companies and even from the television world and the National Weather Service. It's who's our audience and how good of a storyteller are we? And I don't mean that in a, you know, kind of a derogatory way, like we're just, you know, covering our butts and we're just trying to make stuff up. But it literally is. We're all wired for story. I need to know the plot. I need to know what it is that you're interested in. And then as I look at all of this weather information, what makes me unique is the relationship I have with you and my ability to tell you a story from your vantage point.
As someone who's been in this field for how many years have you been doing this?
I'm over 20, I think 25.
So as someone who's done this for a quarter century, can you say which is more complicated to produce a general weather forecast that anyone listening to the radio station can, you know, hear and use in their own way, or producing something, producing a weather forecast for a very specific group of people, but a group of people for whom risk is a big part of the picture?
I would say that the harder but easier one is the one when we have the risk. Because we have very set boundaries. You know, we know what we're looking for. We know how they're going to use that information. We know that if we don't communicate it particularly well, they're going to ask questions to dig in a little bit deeper. So when we're doing the risk assessing, I think that that's the harder forecast to make, but it's also easier from the standpoint that we understand better what we're doing. When we make a general forecast, and that's social media, it's here for WWM, because you think everybody who's listening to this program right now, you don't all live in Milwaukee. You don't all live in what I can see. I'm aware that some of you are listening from Kenosha or Racine or Oconomowoc or Watertown or up north in Fond du Lac. I have to try to make it the weather information and the weather story that I tell be accessible for everybody who's listening at the same time within my 45 seconds or within my social media post, basically the attention span that people have. So in that respect, it's an easier forecast to make because, again, I don't have as much riding on it. But it's harder to make because it's difficult to pin down the details within the allotted time that I have.
Well, and we've been sort of talking around it a little bit, and without getting, you know, into the specifics of your client base, what are the kinds of, you know, generally speaking, the types of customers that have very specific needs from their weather forecast?
Yeah, you know, it's anybody who is adversely affected. So, you know, whether it's entertainment, the entertainment world, you know, the festivals or the Milwaukee Brewers, it's the energy companies. They have a different kind of a risk. Or when the folks are out on the lake, all of them have different risk thresholds. But the concept is all the same. Once we understand what their threshold is, basically they say, if the weather gets to above this, we have problems and it costs us money, it costs us time or credibility. That's what we're looking for. And so we're constantly trying to help them understand what the weather forecast means relative to their risk threshold.
Do you also have to explain to them the limitations of what you're able to do and what you're not able to do?
Exactly. And this is why relational information, and this isn't just for weather, but relational information is so important, because anybody who's talking about the future, because I don't know it, I can't tell you your future, but here's what I can tell you, that based with on a certain set of boundaries and understandings, thresholds, if you will, there is a certain level of probability while there are still other possibilities. And the further out we talk in terms of time, the greater the possibilities, the smaller the probable outcome. And nobody likes to hear that. But it is the reality, and what I think that we're able to do well, and this is why it all comes back to story and relationship, is to be able to help people understand what is the most probable outcome based on all of these different weather things that we're looking at. And while that we have a probable outcome, there are still some possibilities. When we're recording this, there is a small chance for a few isolated showers. Most of us will never see it, but I can't not talk about it because five of you are going to get wet. And I'll hear about it, you know. And so the rest of the 95% of people aren't going to see anything, but they are going to see maybe the cloud that produced it. And so, you know, we have to be able to account for some of those things while still speaking within the probability of the most likely outcome.
Well, right. And so what you're doing is that you're having to apply your interpretation to the information that's available to you, but your clients also have to apply their own interpretation based on what I'm hearing from Mike Westendorf or Innovative Weather. Mm-hmm. I'm going to do X, Y, or Z with that information.
Right, right. And there's this idea of consensus that when you talk about the future, it's important to have consensus. And this is why there's value in the National Weather Service forecast at the same time that I have a forecast that's going out, or what the television guys have to say about it. Everybody who is in a weather-sensitive business is trying to get as many stories as they can so that they can come up with the best consensus. Where we are a specialist is that we have the personal relationship and history and understanding with them so that we can then kind of peel underneath it and explain the why, you know, or that probability and possibility a little bit more clearly and specifically to them.
You can talk probability or possibility, but the Milwaukee Brewers have to be the ones to decide whether to keep the roof open or closed.
Correct. Right. Yeah. We don't tell them what to do. We have to help them understand the risk in the environment that they're in with everything that they're trying to manage. And then they make the call as they see fit.
Mike Westendorf. Thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Mike Westendorf is Operations Manager for Innovative Weather at UW-Milwaukee, and he's an occasional Lake Effect contributor. You can find the latest forecast from Innovative Weather at WUWM.com.
We're shifting gears and taking a few minutes this morning to listen to some poetry. Here is former Milwaukeean turned Minnesotan, Christiana Fritz.
So I've been writing a longer piece. It's more of a novel or a longer story, and these characters had really been haunting me, and I didn't realize how much they were haunting me until they appeared in this poem, and it made me realize that I was troubled by some of the decisions they were making because they were acting out of survival, really, and anything but love, although you could say this poem is about love. After the proposal, hunched over a bucket, peeling potatoes, she knows I've accepted his proposal. No diamond, no flowers, just a question and an affirmation. Brown, dirty peelings making her hands appear all the more delicate. Soft petals shaken from a tree in a land without a war where I could love her. Spin gold from her hair like fairy tales she writes for me in the margins of old books. But here she is, peeling potatoes when I tell her what she already knows, that I'm engaged to be married after kissing her just yesterday in the barn with peeling paint.
And how about this next poem, Meeting Her?
Meeting Her is a poem where I meet my grandmother, who actually died before I was born. I used to spend hours exploring the land around my grandfather's farm, just looking for bits of the lives of the people who had lived there before, like my aunts and uncles, my grandfather and my grandmother. Sometimes I'll imagine the land, the layout of the farm, and walk through it in my mind because it gives these stories that are already fading away a setting. Meeting Her. There's a dream I have where I'm on Opa's abandoned land alone. Grass is overgrown, scratching my legs as I circle the trees and enter one of the barns. There are the usual books, stinking of mildew, broken chairs covered in bird droppings, a bag of old rags stained by car oil, and a golden box. Opening it, I see my Oma, but she's the size of my palm, miniature, eyes the size of a needle's, a red dot for a mouth. She's living and breathing, herself, but smaller. She simply tells me a story about when she was a girl in the woods burying a pebble, believing a mountain would grow there. That's the point where I wake, feeling as if I'd finally met her.
Writer Christiana Fritz is a former Milwaukeean who now lives in Minnesota's Twin Cities.
A short break now, and then we'll visit an unusual but well-loved performance space on Milwaukee's East Side, a trip to the Jazz Estate when Lake Effect continues on WUWN.
Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Last week, we brought you an interview with and a performance by Milwaukee trumpeter Eric Jacobson. In addition to playing with several jazz combos in the area, Jacobson is also responsible for booking performances at one of the area's leading venues for music in that genre, the East Side's Jazz Estate.
John Dye, who also owns Bryant's on the South Side, bought and renovated the Jazz Estate in the last couple of years. I visited him one noontime at the space on Murray Avenue, just north of North Avenue.
So, John, first of all, thank you for meeting me here at the Jazz Estate. Well, the newly revamped Jazz Estate.
Absolutely.
So how long have you been here? When did you purchase it? And what made you decide to venture to the north side, or at least the east side?
Right. The east side, definitely. So I believe I purchased it in August of 2015 and then closed right about in that fall there. We closed it for about a year to do the renovations. It took longer than we had expected, but I think that's a pretty common situation in this game. So, but we wanted to do things right. At first, we just were going to try to renovate the space, and we were hoping when we took down some of the wood paneling, we'd find really neat stuff, but we actually didn't find any neat stuff at all. So,
like old posters or that
old
kind of
posters
thing?
Or great wallpaper, or just something we could work off for a more of a historic renovation. So we ended up having to go back to the drawing board and sort of reimagine the space and what it could be, or maybe what it could have been, 30, 40, 50 years ago.
The building that we're sitting in, do you know the age of it and what it was before it was a club?
So this building actually has a really interesting history. The area we're sitting in now is the basement of a house that was built in the 1890s. Everything that kind of goes from the bar back has the lower ceiling is the basement of an old house that they just slowly dug out over time to increase their space. The front that looks like a storefront from the street is actually built in the 30s, right around the Great Depression. And as far as we can tell, it was a real estate office, but we have a feeling that maybe it just sort of sat vacant for a little while. And then a bar opened, I believe, in around 1938, 39.
And did they have music, do you know? Is there history of that?
So the family that owned it, they sort of owned it off and on through the entire time. They were really, really huge fans of music. So they would have music. The story is that one of the old owners went to World War II and came back with a love of jazz music. So it was just sort of this change in his life that brought him to appreciate jazz, and he would play it all the time. And finally, he was the same fellow who called it the estate and made it a jazz club in the 70s.
Okay, so we're talking about 40 years of this being an active jazz club of some kind.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's been the estate since around 1977.
Now, we're not in a very big space. As you said, it's a former basement, or
right.
At least a basement digging back. So take me on a little tour.
We like to call it intimate space. But it is small. It is small, which I think is one of the charms of it. It seats about 64 people or so. As you walk in, there's a bar, and then you look back, and the stage is sort of in the middle of the room. So when you're watching a live act, you're either sitting right directly in front of the stage or to one of the sides. So the nice thing about that is it really brings this experience with the music. I mean, every seat you're right by the stage. So sometimes when you're watching a performance, you're really right in the performance with the artist, which is really neat. And I think that's been one of the successes of the estate over the years. It's just this feeling of being really close to the artists.
Now, how do the artists feel about that? Do they like having the audience that close?
I think they do. I think they do. I've never asked that specific questions, but I do know that the artists really like playing here, and they always have. Even through all the changes, even before we did the renovation, they really liked playing here. It just always had this really great community feel to it. And that is one of the main elements of jazz music, as the community. So it's just very important to this space and to the musicians. Since the remodel, I think that they like that there's been some improvements in the sound quality. They don't hit their head on the ceiling anymore like they used to.
Well,
so,
unless they're like basketball players.
Right, right. Because we actually raised the ceiling about a foot in some places. So it's considerably larger than it used to be.
Is there anything still above us?
Yes, it's an apartment upstairs. So
okay.
It's sort of seen different uses. It was a green room for a little while. It was offices. The previous owners lived up there. Some of them did. And then there's an apartment on the third floor also. So it's just sort of an old East Side house. If you went up there, you'd be like, yeah, this is a house from the East Side.
Except you have a jazz club in your basement.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And the ceiling didn't used to be soundproofed either. So I think that really was the music was right upstairs with them. But we soundproofed it, so I think they're a lot happier up there.
What is the difference for you as someone who owns a different venue in a different part of town? What's the difference up here versus down in the South Side?
It's funny. It is a lot different. Both the neighborhoods have a very different feel. Even though the feel of the spaces actually have a lot of similarities, just the general feel of the neighborhood and the way the space interacts with the neighborhood is much different. As you know, Bryant sort of sits on a corner on the south side in a residential area. There's not much going on around it. It just sort of is its own little realm of cocktails. So whereas the estate, we more interact with the neighborhood. We have people walking by. You know, when the door opens, you can hear the music going into the street, which is almost, it kind of reminds me of almost a New Orleans feel, which I think is really neat. It is funny how I've really learned that there are East Side clientele and there are South Side, and people don't cross over as much as I think that they probably should. I kind of wish people would get out and explore the city a little bit more and get out of their comfort zone. So,
but at the same time, I think it's kind of fun to have your neighborhood joint.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And do you see the estate being a neighborhood joint?
Yep.
In the good sense?
Definitely. Absolutely. And I think it always has. It's always had this sort of dual purposes, and we really wanted to sort of expand on that. So we added a really great cocktail program. Jeff Kinder actually did all of the drinks. He's a great bartender. So we have this sort of cocktail lounge feel when music's not playing. When there is music, it's great music with great cocktails. So they really play well together. And we are open 7 days a week at 5. So it's nice. So people can like stop here after work. And we are starting to get that crowd, starting to build up the neighborhood crowd. And I actually happen to live in the neighborhood, and this is one of the closest bars to my house. So I'm pretty happy about it, too.
Now, as far as the musicians go, we're just looking at the May schedule, and it looks like there's something almost every night now. Are you finding that things are booking up?
So we started at 2 nights a week because we wanted to see how the live music went. And now we're starting to add more. And it's not every night, but every other night, every 3 nights, something's going on here. And we're trying to vary the music so that sometimes we'll have an artist from New York or Chicago coming in, sort of a bigger show like that. We have a lot of the local artists here, which I mean, Milwaukee has just some incredibly talented musicians. It's just absolutely amazing. We then also have open jams and stuff like that to sort of fill in some of the other times. But there's always a really great energy here with the music.
You talk about the kinds of music. Is it always jazz, or are you branching out into other genres of music as well, or are you pretty much sticking to the jazz and blues thing?
At this point, we are probably 95% jazz, so we really want to establish ourselves as being related to the jazz community here. And so we've played with a few other different types of music, and you know, jazz has different definitions to different people too. So some things I think that we play that I would consider jazz, I think a lot of maybe old timers would come in and be like, that is not jazz. So, but it is great music.
You're talking to about the more modern stuff.
Right. Yeah. And then we even had we had a bluegrass band, which was really neat in here. So it really fit the space well, and it's definitely, when the music's going on here, it has this really great mini venue feel to it. It's really neat. So.
Well, just sitting in here right now, I mean, we're here, it's noon. Right. Obviously, you're not open to the public yet. You opened for me to come in and sit and talk with you. But there's a wonderful sort of warmth to this space. I'm reminded of like small jazz clubs in New York without the smell.
We got rid of the smell.
Got rid of the smell.
It's funny. I think a lot of bars, since the smoking ban, have it's taken a while to sort of get that smell out of the spaces. And,
right.
But yeah, this definitely, it reminds me of Small's Jazz Club in the Village in New York. And it definitely has just this really great small venue feel to it.
How did you get interested? And why did you want to become a proprietor of a place that showcased jazz?
Well, it was actually the history of the space that attracted me. I'm very attracted to histories of businesses. So that's why I was attracted to Bryant's, is because it has this great cocktail history in the city. And then the estate, it has a great jazz history. And if somebody hadn't stepped in, I don't think it would be here right now. It was sort of on its last leg. And even with the space, there was just a lot of maintenance that had been sort of put off over the years that had turned into larger problems. And so it was sort of stepping in to save a historic venue.
But then talk about the business side of it. I mean, do you expect that you're going to eventually make a profit on this? Or is this a labor of love?
It's a little bit of both. I don't think I've chosen a career path where money is the primary. As much as people think that is in this business, it actually, you have to have the passion for it. Somebody told me, how do you make $1 million at the jazz club? You start out with two. It's one of those businesses that a lot of people would say is dying, but if you go to other cities, I don't think that is the case, and now you're seeing in Milwaukee that it's not the case either. There's Gibraltar that just opened on the south side. Evan's doing an awesome job there. And to have two great jazz venues open in the same year is just a really neat thing, and I think it says a lot about this city.
Well, and you also have the Carolines. It's been around for a while, so there's one in Walker's Point.
Absolutely.
And so it seems like you could go from the south side up to the east side and stop along the way and hear some different music.
Definitely, and that's a really neat thing to have. There's also the Jazz Gallery in River West that puts on a lot of great...
Yeah, they've been around for about a year?
Yep, about a year, I think. And then there's Company Brewing also does some great jazz stuff. So it's just really neat to see this genre sort of building up in the city again. And yeah, I mean, you could almost be a jazz tourist here.
Do you think jazz is finding new audiences then? I mean, are audiences responding to it in ways that surprise you?
They are. And one thing I was really surprised of is how young the crowd is. It's young and energetic. And I think something that maybe has been forgotten in jazz music over the years is that there is a fun element to it. and there should be a fun element to it. It's a type of music that sort of started out almost as a party music. And I think sometimes we lost sight of that over the years, just looking at the technical aspects of it. But if you make it fun, people do respond to it. And it makes for one of the best nights, you know, of the month, is to go out and hear a great jazz band and have some drinks and just have a good time.
So you're seeing young people come in here.
Absolutely, absolutely.
That's
fantastic.
It's,
yeah, and it was, again, it was surprising. It was a surprise to me.
You're expecting the middle-aged and older crowd.
Yep.
And do they show up too?
They also show up. Okay. It's a very diverse crowd here, which is neat. It's and it's similar to Brian's. It's just a very diverse crowd that walks through the door, and I think that's really valuable for the city.
So any ideas of maybe doing a jazz festival?
That's funny. We have thought of that. I think it'd be really neat to do an East Side Jazz Festival. We could do it right outside, I suppose. It would be a lot of fun. I think it would also be neat to sort of take over underutilized spaces in the city and do 1 or 2 day long jazz festivals in those spaces, because I think that combines both of my interests, which is saving these historic spaces and music and having a great time.
So check in with you is what you're saying.
Yes, definitely.
Well, John Dye, thank you so much for taking some time today and talking with us, and best of luck with this.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. It's nice to meet you.
John Dye is the proprietor of the Jazz Estate on Milwaukee's East Side. You can find a list of their upcoming gigs and much more at WUWM.com.
Milwaukee's Rev-O-Matics wouldn't fit, either physically or in style, at the Jazz Estate, but they do fit on our show and in our performance space just fine. We'll hear some tunes as they get ready to release a new album when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. The Milwaukee-based surf band The Rev-O-Matics made their first Lake Effect appearance 2 years ago when they released their first album, We Come in Peace. Since then, the group has performed locally and toured the Midwest, spreading their spin on reverb-laden guitar to diverse audiences. In addition to their own shows, they've also shared the stage as openers for the likes of the B-52s, surf legend Dick Dale, and Rich Robinson of the Black Crows.
The Rev-O-Matics are on the verge of releasing their second album, Nocturnia, in which they've drifted away from their original focus on classic surf rock sounds and moved to a newer and grittier interpretation of the genre.
Guitarists Drew DeLudio and Joe Weigel, bassist Peter Flessis, and drummer Jeff Schneider joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in the performance studio for a preview of their new album, starting with the title track, Nocturnia.
And in the Lake Effect Performance Studio, that was the Rev-O-Matics with Nocturnia. Welcome back, guys.
Thanks, Audrey.
So since the last time we had you guys in, I can already tell a great sound difference and just a new direction. And, you know, on your bio, you have that we're actively trying to evolve a genre of music that never really got an opportunity to grow. And even just from your first album, We Come in Peace, I can tell you still have the surf rock element, but you're kind of taking it to a new place. So what were you guys thinking going into the second album? And as you grew as musicians, wrote new songs, what did you want to accomplish? What did you want to do to take it to that next level?
Well, we had a lot of success a little over a year ago when we released We Come in Peace. And, you know, a lot of that success came from people who weren't necessarily familiar with surf music discovering us and coming to see our band and, you know, playing shows with other bands that, you know, weren't necessarily fixtures in the genre. So it wasn't so much like, I think, a conscious decision that we made. I think we just naturally started to gravitate away from more traditional sounding surf music and realized that there was a lot of room for more instrumental music and that we were, you know, there was a lot of people that were really receptive to that. And at the same time, you know, we didn't want to alienate or we didn't want to like burn any bridges so that we, you know, weren't able to continue playing with, you know, artists like Dick Dale and, you know, these surf mainstays. But like we found that if anything, I think it's like it's grown the appeal of our band.
And I can see you've already added some pedals for your guitars, some looping.
That's
you
super
know,
cool. Audrey,
expanding upon it, and which is really great. So, you know, even with you guys as individual players, what did each of you want to do specifically? Like, I've always thought of doing this. Let's try and incorporate it.
Well, Drew and I are, we play with other surf bands and they look at our rigs and they start by kind of looking down their noses at us a little bit because, you know, I mean, I've got a humbucker on this Telecaster and we both have overdrives on our pedal boards. We have stuff that, like the traditional guys who just play super clean Fender amps with Stratocasters don't play in the surf genre. So it's I've almost gotten to the point where I'm intentionally like looking for weird stuff to put on my board that can give me flavors that just don't exist in the
genre.
Yeah, in the genre and in the pantheon of instrumental music that's mm-hmm. that's come before us.
Right, and Jeff, I mean, there's no additional pedals or electronics with a drum set, but what did you want to
but
bring
But if it were
the
up to me, there would be.
Yeah, you could give Jeff a pedal.
Well, I can certainly add some, maybe another bass drum,
right.
You know, another dozen cymbals or so.
But, like, you play with a, you know, like, you use a five-piece kit, which
yeah, right.
a lot, like, isn't necessarily
Yeah, most surf drummers use a four-piece or even a three-piece. Mm-hmm. You know, I come from more of jazz and rock background, so this is what I'm comfortable with. In terms of your original question, I think I myself want to keep progressing, want this group to keep progressing and trying different things. And I think one of the great things about this band is we all come from different backgrounds. We all bring different styles of music to the mix. Mm-hmm. So I think that makes us a lot different than a lot of other bands. We're not looking straight ahead and saying, okay, we're only going to do surf. We're never going to change. We want to evolve and keep evolving. So, mm-hmm.
See, and I'm the grandpa of the band. I go back
you started
to,
it off.
I go back to the 1980s. So I was, you know, I have a punk rock background. I still consider myself to be sort of a punk rock bass player. So I keep things pretty basic. I'm playing my Fender Jag, but I like to switch off with different bass guitars. I don't use effects per se. I just feel it's more in the feel of the instrument and just every bass that I have has a little different sound to it. So I'll switch off between instruments. But it's certainly been an evolution for the band. You know, we started this, Jeff and I, about 6 years ago. And since we had the addition of Drew and then Joe, and everything just came together and clicked at that point, and we've really coalesced as a band.
So how long has it been with just the four of you, strictly?
Oh, at least.
It's about we're coming on 3 years.
3 years.
Okay.
Just about, yeah.
And as you've grown and toured around, more importantly, not just mm-hmm. working on your own album when you have the time to get together and do that, but as you've gone to different places, whether it's local, out of state, what has the audience response been, and what do you guys take away from tours? What do you learn to put back in the studio?
That's an awesome question. That, I want to take that because I feel like we have traveled a lot, and we've gotten the opportunity to play, you know, not only on traditional small tours, but we've also played relatively large venues for more national touring acts, and the response that we get outside of Milwaukee is always really, really positive. I wish it was we were just joking, but you know, when we always talk about how when we go to Chicago or for example, like a city like Minneapolis, which we played this summer, or as far south as Atlanta, we always come back feeling like incredibly motivated because we play these shows to these in these scenes where people come out to see original bands, and there's this expectation that like the band that's getting on stage is going to provide them with something new and something original and something that will interest them. And we don't play locally as much anymore just because that's a lot more difficult in Milwaukee, especially for a band like us that is really difficult to pigeonhole or to label. But I know that there's a lot of other bands, original acts in town that would like agree with me that, mm-hmm. you know, Milwaukee can be a pretty unforgiving town for touring bands or original acts that are born here just because of the festival scene that exists here and the expectation that, you know, when you go see a band live, they're going to provide you with entertainment, you know, maybe as opposed to like a piece of art.
Do you think that age is a factor when it comes to being successful in a certain city? Just that.
Well, the guys in Solo called
rock is
the guys in Solo called us an old guy band.
Yeah,
not a bad way, but the Milwaukee music scene. A lot of people that come in and out are, you know, young 20s, teens, yeah. and they're like, I'm going to take my career, I want to lift it off. And with Milwaukee and the festival scene focusing on, you know, these are new talents up and coming, that the emphasis on people who have worked hard and established and, you know, really found their sound maybe don't get as much attention.
I can tell you it's a lot easier at this point doing a band. You know, I feel that I've made all the mistakes or most of them at this point, and pretty much it's just a wide open road now, mm-hmm. and we just cruise along, and it gets easier. Mm-hmm. I think so.
Yeah, I totally agree with Pete. Like at this point, like it's a real asset for us to have as much experience as we do. I know it's cliche, like are we old guys? We're just like experienced dudes, but like, but I think that, you know, yeah, like it totally is a young man's game or a woman's game. But if you're able to kind of keep it together and get through all the nonsense that usually breaks bands up when you're at that point in your life where you have to start making decisions about how you're going to put food on your table for the next 45 years. Like, I feel, you know, we're all past that. And so I think that there's probably younger bands that might think that at a certain point, like, all that's going to have to kind of stop. And, you know, quote unquote, real life takes over. And, you know, 90% of the guys and gals doing it are going to check out. And we're lucky enough to have made it through all of that and, like, now are able to do all these really interesting shows. And we can manage our money and, like, our time. And we can communicate with each other effectively and respectfully. And, we can disagree about things and
there's no ego problems.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, you know, we have a tremendous amount of respect for each other because we're also adults.
Yeah, there's something that, I guess there's a certain luxury of getting to this point in your life where you're a seasoned player and you're doing it because you love it and you don't have to quit, you know. And we're all lucky because we have families that totally embrace the fact that we're musicians.
You know, and speaking of old guys, we had an opportunity recently to open up for Dick Dale.
Tell him what an old guy is.
The man is 79 years old and he's still going. He's the Energizer bunny.
Yeah.
He keeps going and going. And it's really inspiring to see him perform. And I don't know where he gets the energy from, but the guy still kills it.
Yeah.
Well, maybe other bands can learn that it's about enjoying it and it's not about trying to be successful in a monetary or in a media way. And ultimately, I think you guys would agree that no matter what your timing on the scene, nothing can make up for the time you guys have spent playing your instruments and really focusing on that. So before we talk about the new album, let's hear another song.
Sure. This is called... So there's a quick story I have to tell before we play this. And I tell this live too, and I know everybody in the band's getting sick of it. But when we were on a couple smaller tours in support of our last record, Joe and I were traveling together, and to pass time in the car, I don't know what was said, but we got into a discussion about the Dirty Dozen, and I was arguing that Lee Marvin was the coolest of the Dirty Dozen, and I told Joe that I would put the kibosh on the issue by writing a song called Lee Marvin. So this tune's called Lee Marvin.
was the Rev-O-Matics with Lee Marvin. Joe, that was some awesome effects to add to the end of that.
Thank you.
You know, it's,
they indulge me.
Yeah. Let you play around with the toys.
It's always a bit of an acrobatic move.
Yeah. Just upon hearing you guys with these couple songs compared to your last visit, I don't want to say it's more aggressive. That's not the right word for it, but it's
I use the term
assertive aggressive.
That's a really good description.
When we talked about going to the studio to do the album we're finishing right now, Drew and I were talking, and I used the term abrupt. There's a lot on the new album that is very abrupt in terms of its attitude and its sound. Now, in the studio, in the mixing phase, we've kind of, I think, rounded out some of those edges. But the goal, for the band was to go in and record something that kind of captured what we sound like on stage. And on stage, we do tend to have a really edgy, kind of abrupt sound, especially with some of the shorter stuff like the song we just played.
We made a conscious decision this time around to actually record it live in the studio, as opposed to our last album, We Come in Peace, which we spent several months tracking it. But I think this album has a little bit more edginess to it. There's a lot more presence, and it was a fun album to record.
Yeah, there's a lot more character on this. And we played so much between the last album and when we decided to record. And a lot happened in my life personally. Like, I had more kids and, you know, I was just juggling all sorts of, you know, old guy responsibilities. And like, you know, I wanted this music to get recorded. And, you know, we all kind of agreed, like, all right, let's not overthink it. Let's put our band on tape the way we sound live when we go and travel and play these shows. And yeah, I think we nailed it, because Joe's right. We do have this, we appeal to people who are into heavier music.
And Jeff and I have been performing together for 6 years now. And, you know, we've really coalesced as a rhythm section.
Right.
And,
mm-hmm.
you know, we can kind of sense each other's vibe. And I believe that's laid an excellent foundation for both Drew and Joe to layer on their guitars. And it's really worked well now with the band. We've really locked it in.
And I don't feel like we, you know, in most bands where you have a vocalist, the whole way that the band interacts is sort of revolves around the vocal structure of the song. And without that, you know, especially our rhythm section, like if that wasn't rock solid, this wouldn't work at all.
You know, being a bass player, I'm often asked by, you know, kids, they're like, hey, how come you don't play guitar? You know, guitar is a lot cooler. But I always say, you know, as a bass player, I have to hold the band together. I have to attach the drums to the melody. I'm the go-between. And if I'm playing terribly or if I'm an awful bass player, it's going to fall apart. So to me, you know, I've always felt the bass is one of the most important instruments. I have to hold the band together.
Well, I'd like to thank you, Jeff, Peter, Drew, and Joe for coming in. And it's always a great thing to have you back. And
thanks so much for having us. We really, really appreciate it.
Absolutely.
And I genuinely enjoy like being here. This is a lot of fun.
We're happy to have you. So let's give the listeners one more song of this strong group dynamic that you've established. What are you going to play us out with?
So this song was named by my 4-year-old son, Jack. It's called Have a Good Nice Day.
Have a good nice day. That sounds great.
So that's what we'd like to leave you with. Have a good nice day from the Rev-O-Matics.
Drew DeLudio, Joe Weigel, Peter Flessis, and Jeff Schneider make up Milwaukee's surf rock band, the Rev-O-Matics. Their second album, Nocturnia, is due to be released soon. For more information on the band and to hear their first interview with us, visit WUWM.com. And that is all for the Monday edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, your NPR station in Milwaukee.
Right now, it is 11 o'clock. We're just about an hour away from all the latest news from NPR and WBUR in Boston on Here and Now. But fresh air comes your way next.